Welcome to the Wine Scholar Guild podcast. I'm Valerie Caruso. Today, we are featuring a conversation with Andrew Jefford of Decanter Magazine and the Wine Scholar Guild's academic advisor, and Olivier Humbrecht of Domaine Zin Humbrecht and Master of Wine. This interview will be done in two parts. The first part will cover Olivier's accomplished journey as France's first Master of Wine and the history of his vineyards and his domain. The second part will explore more thoroughly Olivier's philosophy of non-interventionism and biodynamic principles and practices. Andrew, Olivier, welcome.
Thank you, Valerie. And it's great to be with you, Olivier. As always, I always learn a huge amount. I'm sure we're going to learn a huge amount today. Let's kick off, if we could, by you just telling us a little bit about the history of the domain. I know your family goes back a long way in Alsace.
Vineyards in Alsace goes back to basically the 10th century or something like that. The Humbrecht family has been wine grower from father to son since the beginning of the 17th century, and I am the number 12th generation to make wines in the Humbrecht family here. The domain itself, Zin Humbrecht, is actually the reunion of my father and mother's vineyards, Zin and Humbrecht. They got married in 59, created Zin Humbrecht, and that was the beginning of a new estate.
Fantastic. It must be wonderful to have that huge length of history behind you. I think it's very hard for people like us to imagine. We're such rootless individuals nowadays, whereas you've got these fantastic roots going back centuries.
It is actually very amazing. Yeah. Unfortunately, we often realize how little we know from our distant ancestors.
Yeah. Okay, just give us some idea of what it was like to grow up in a wine domain. Did you always love wine? Were you always fascinated by wine? Or was it the sort of the boring thing that took your parents away from you very often?
Well, back in the 60s and 70s, the winery of my parents was still very small. They only started with 5 hectares of vineyard. Father developed what I would call the vineyard collector syndrome and started to buy vineyard in very interesting places all over Alsace, and the winery grew up in a sort of crazy and frantic way, especially in the 70s and 80s. I can't really remember when I actually fell into the wine barrel. I remember being a kid, always being the one being designated to go pick up the next bottle of wine in the cellar if there wouldn't be enough wine on the table. And I would very quickly learn which wine my family or my father would prefer me to pick in the cellar. And I probably got the real, got hooked up, probably was like 14 and 15, and decided to clean up my father's old cellar where he had all the old bottles. And that really sort of triggered probably something. When you're in a wine family, you can't tell exactly when you actually all started.
Did you ever consider not being a wine grower when you were older?
No, I don't remember any time I would not think of becoming what I am today.
Your destiny.
Probably, I don't know.
Anyway, you really sealed your destiny in many ways when you became France's first ever Master of Wine. Now, how did that happen to a young man from Alsace?
Well, I spent almost 2 years in London at the end of my studies. After my agronomy and enology studies, I had to do my military service, which I ended up doing at Sopexa, Food and Wine from France in London, working for a French company, not having to go around with a gun on my shoulder at the army because I had a very small experience that I didn't really enjoy. And I met my wife in London eventually, but I also met a lot of very interesting people, including Liz and Mike Berry, who at the time had this wonderful little wine shop on Old Brompton Road called La Vigneronne and L'Alsacienne. And she said, Olivier, the MW Institute is opening its door in 1987 to non-British people. I think you should try to follow the program. I went with my gun on the shoulder, with a flower at the end, as we say in French, la fleur au fusil, and didn't know what to expect. Eventually passed the test. They accepted my semi-good English at the time and went for the program. And then I thought to myself, all these English people that were laughing at this little young French guy, probably with a very small, you know, knowledge on the world of wine globally. So I, from something that I just took as a game and, you know, intellectual interest, it became a challenge.
But it was a
very
tough,
fascinating time. It was tough and interesting at the same time. I have to say, the groups I was with, the tutorial groups, my tutors and all that, were absolutely fantastic people. We met very, very often. We're all based in London and tasted many, many different wines. The tough part was for me to be obliged also to learn and taste wines which would not be within my philosophy of wine, if you know what I mean.
Sure. But do you think it made you a better winemaker in the long run?
Well, I think, and that's why I also tell my son who just joined the estate this summer, I said, you know, it's important to know what you need to do and what is a great wine. It's also important to understand why a wine is bad and what you should not do. You know? So any knowledge you can get in wine, from traveling, from meeting people, from getting from not just your wine area, can only be positive. And when I look in my region, the people who probably make the less interesting wine are the people that don't go out of their cellar and their vineyards and don't know anything that's happening just even next village, you know? So, yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I've always thought when I go around traveling and visiting wine growers, if ever you use a huge Catholic collection of empty bottles on the entrance to the cellar, bottles from all over the world, it's usually a very good sign that the winemaker will be really an outstanding achiever. Great. Well, let's go back to the Domaine now and talk a little bit about that. Now, you mentioned your father became a kind of serial vineyard acquirer during your childhood. How did he do that? What were his principles? I mean, was it simply getting hold of whatever was available, or did he have a guiding idea about what he wanted and where he wanted it?
It's very hard to explain, but he got passionate about wine. And having married my mother, who was from another village with a totally different set of vineyards and grape varieties and style of wines, it was quite probably eye-opening for him at a time where wine growers would just stay in the village and have literally vineyards reachable by horse distance, you know, which means just a couple of miles from the winery and would not go any further away. So he started to study the history of Alsace, the region, read books, and thought to himself, as he always said, you know, if a vineyard has been famous for 300 or 400 or 500 years or more, and you can find it in many books in the past, despite the varying quality of wine growers taking care of it, it probably means the vineyard has something that goes beyond just the talent of the person making the wine. So he was always going around seeking for this vineyard. And where I'm a little bit jealous is that in the 60s and 70s, these vineyards were available. You know, Alsace acreage was maybe 30,000 hectares in the 17th century. It went down to 6,000 hectares at the end of the Second World War. So a lot of these famous historical vineyards were abandoned or in very poor shape because they were very costly to manage, very complicated on very steep slopes. But they were also pretty much available. And that's not the case today anymore.
He did have a sense of the historical destiny of each vineyard in his mind as he worked. It wasn't simply, how good does it look on a kind of casual glance basis. He actually worked with some history research.
Absolutely, yeah. But, you know, I don't know any great vineyard which is not surrounded by a certain energy and a certain landscape and quality of landscape also. There are maybe a few exceptions, sadly, but most of the time, any great vineyard around the world is also set into a place where you have a sense of beauty, you know. But it's true, a nice-looking vineyard, a nice-looking forest is sometimes not enough to, you know, guarantee that the wines are goes to that extra level and are capable to really show the potential of a place into a wine. Because that's ultimately what my father and myself and I hope my son are trying to achieve, you know.
And something else that's always interested me in Alsace, where you're working with different varieties, and usually, not always, but usually making a different wine from those different varieties. Did your father, when he acquired a new vineyard, immediately know that it was going to be a great Riesling site, or it was going to be a great Pinot Gris site? Or is there a measure of experiment that comes after you buy a vineyard and you have to discover actually what the vineyard can do best?
It's probably both. I would say that someone who has a certain experience sometimes acquired by the weight of history and past, you know, it's much easier sometimes to understand an area when viticulture was part of the culture for a very, very long time. You know what you should do, what you shouldn't do. Sometimes you forget what you should do. And so it's always good to go back and understand why certain things are done in a certain way. But there is also a very strong sense of intuition and gut feeling, which is an accumulation of personal experience, history, reading, field experience and all that. And even myself, when I look at the vineyard, I know if I can make a good wine or not. I have that gut feeling. Mm-hmm. And that's something which is very, very hard to explain. It's not just a combination of climatic, technical factors, soil type and whatever, drainage, or all those things are definitely very, very important. But eventually, a great site goes beyond just a list of technical requirements.
And there is a certain amount of overlap between the key varieties in Alsace vis-a-vis certain sites. In other words, some sites are good for several different varieties, aren't they? It's not just one variety that a site insists on.
Yes, absolutely. Some vineyards have this capability to magnify and allow a lot of different grapes to become very, very successful. Some other, because they have some specific characteristics, will be much better in some type of wine or some grape varieties more specifically. That's something which is also very difficult to assess sometimes, because sometimes you can enjoy or appreciate a wine based on your personal curses, based on your personal taste, based on the culture of the wine at the moment, and what you also try to achieve. So choosing a grape variety in a site is a very, very difficult thing. It's a mix of different things, technical requirements, the style of wine you try to achieve, and what eventually the vineyard is the most happy to work with also.
Mm, okay. Well, let's put all this into practice by going through some of your key vineyards. Let's start with your village, Turckheim, and particularly the Herrenweg vineyard, which is the vineyard that surrounds the winery. Indeed, it's a huge, big vineyard. I think it's about 60 hectares altogether. You, I think, have 11 and a half hectares of it. Now, you know, at first glance, to the innocent eye, using our kind of Burgundy principles that people tend to travel around with when they assess vineyards, it doesn't look like it's going to be terribly good. It's all flat. But in fact, it is quite good, isn't it? So what's going on there? Tell us a little bit about that.
Would you like me to make the list of all the world vineyards which are famous and completely flat?
Well, I only mentioned the Burgundy analogy because at first glance, Alsace looks like Burgundy. It's got the slopes. Yes. So tends to think all the great vineyard is going to be mid-slope on the Burgundy basis. It doesn't look like the Medoc, which is obviously works on a completely different basis. Yeah. Anyway, tell us all about it.
It is true that in our part of the world, most Valifort are made of ordinary silt or wind deposits, licensing like that. And also Valifort tends to keep more water. The drainage capacity of the soil is a very important element in assessing the potential quality, agronomical quality of a soil. So in an area where it rains a lot, a slope is something that would help. In Alsace, especially the Herrenweg vineyard, is probably located in one of the driest places in Alsace. We enjoy an extremely dry climate there, the driest in France, based on the past 10-year statistics. So being flat is not an issue at this level. And the Herrenweg, like a few of the valley floor of old glacier or rivers coming out of the Vosges Mountains is made of very big pebbles. They are very warm, very well drained. The roots can go to a certain depth. And it can make an interesting style of wine, which is dominated by the sun and the climate element and the warmth of the soil.
Yeah. So in a way, actually, it is a kind of Bordeaux-like soil, isn't it? Gravel soils, well-drained gravel soils.
Bordeaux, or even perhaps more Southern Rhone, valley floor, big pebbles.
Yeah.
I'm not going to mention names now, but you know what I mean.
We do. Okay, well, let's talk about a couple of other Turckheim vineyards you have. Heimburg, and this, I believe, was one which was pretty much abandoned when your father got hold of it. Was that right?
Indeed. And that's why he managed to get about half of the potential of the vineyard site, which is 4.5 hectares out of 9 hectares. It's relatively steep. The slope goes from 40 to 50% slope, so it's pretty difficult to cultivate. And it was one of these vineyards that was abandoned post-war because it was too expensive to run, the yield would be lower, the cultivation manually at the time was more complicated, and people went more for easier to work vineyard with machines. And so, yeah, I remember also helping him in the late 80s, because the last vineyard we planted in Heimburg was about in 1996, so it's not so long ago. And, you know, cutting trees, removing old wires from vineyard that dated probably back to the 20s or 30s. And it's a fantastic vineyard on Oligocene limestone soil, it's a kind of, I compare it to a nougat kind of soil where the nuts would be limestone rocks, which are sealed within a sandstone made of limestone. So it looks like a big nougat where the rocks of limestone looks like the almonds, and the white sugar would be the sandstone into it. It's very red in color because of the iron. It makes fantastic wine. It's a great vineyard.
And you have a Pinot Noir there, I believe.
It's the only vineyard of red wine that we have is today located in this vineyard. It's just 3/4 acre. We make our 3-4 barrels of red wine every year from there. Mm-hmm. We don't produce much red wine, and that's the only one we make.
Yeah. And there's another vineyard, a Clos vineyard you have in Turckheim called Clos Jebsal.
Yes,
Jebsal. This, again, was, I believe, abandoned when your father got hold of it, even though it lies right underneath the Grand Cru of Brandt. Is that right?
Yeah. It's the biggest part of the Clos Jebsal is in an extremely steep slope, and it's only 1.3 hectare in one piece, delimited like this, 1.3 hectare, and it belonged to 6 different wine growers. So my father probably started to buy the first vineyard within the Jebsal back in the 70s. It took him almost 12 years to buy all the vineyards that would allow him to unite all the parcels together to be able to replant properly the vineyard in 1983. In 82, 81, we owned the entire Clos, which allowed us to make it to rebuild the walls and everything, the terraces and all that in this vineyard. Again, it was abandoned because of the slope. It was too steep, too difficult to work. All these 6 vineyards individually were very, very small for every grower to invest into it. And I remember when my father started to buy the vineyard over there, he brought my grandmother, Mother Zind, in front of it, said, "That's my latest acquisition." And he said, "Why on hell did you buy this heap? What can you do with it?" And he said, "Well, I saw in an old book in Turckheim that it was one of the very famous vineyards in the village back in the 16th century. And the soil looked fantastic, marl and all this. And here we go." Yeah.
Wow. It's amazing to think that these fantastic sites were just lying, waiting to be discovered as late as, you know, the last 20, 30 years. It's incredible to think about that. Well, let's go on now to Vinzenheim, which is just south of Turckheim. Here you have some land in the Grand Cru of Hengst, but you also have vineyards above and below Hengst in the Rottenburg and the Clos Heuserer.
Yeah.
Tell us about those.
Hill is based on an Oligocene limestone, red in color because it's rich in iron. And the Hengst, which is in the the middle of the hill facing southeast, is for me a place which has always produced amazing Gewürztraminers. And for a very long time, that was the only grape we had in this vineyard. Just above and going towards the western side of the hill, the soils become steeper, poorer, more rocky. And we always planted in this vineyard the Pinot family grapes. So we have some Auxerrois Pinot Blanc that goes into our blend. Of Pinot Blanc. We don't use the vineyard name there, but the Pinot Gris has been bottled since 1985 as a single vineyard, Rotenberg. On the bottom of the hill, which is richer, because you always have a natural erosion on any hillsides, you have an accumulation of more marl. The soil is much deeper. We talk here about 1 meter of depth of soil before you hit the mother rock. My father also combined together a dozen of very small vineyards, eventually pulled them out in the early 70s, replanted the vineyard in 1973 entirely with Riesling, and called this big square right on the bottom of the Hengst the Plo Häuserer, because Häuserer comes from the name of the road just next week called Häuserweg, which is a road to the houses. Not the local modern development of houses, but houses that were built by the Romans in the middle of the hill back in the 6th century.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Gosh.
Hence the
amazing.
Name Häuserer. It's a road to the houses, the Roman houses.
The Roman villas.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, a vineyard I particularly want to talk about, Olivier, is Clos Winsbühl in Hunavir. This is quite a way north of Turckheim, up almost as far as Ribeauvillé. This is a vineyard with an absolutely fantastic history to it, often mentioned in the Middle Ages, formerly owned by the Habsburg family, truly a great historic vineyard. And yet it's not actually a Grand Cru. So why would that be? Why isn't it a Grand Cru?
Well, the vineyard was owned and managed. The last lineage of people with the Mayer family that acquired the vineyard in the 1880s. The last person making wine there at the Winsbühl was Mr. Jean Mayer back in the 1960s. When he passed over, the family gave the vineyard to another producer who didn't put the vineyard forward on the label, was not a believer of Grand Cru, didn't submit the vineyard to the INAO classification process. And also being a sole owner and one bottler of this wine, at the time, the INAO also insisted that classified vineyard must be worked by multiple producers. So all this put together meant that the vineyard went through the classification and was not selected. There is a Premier Cru classification underway, his way in Alsace. It will still take a few years to be finalized. It's not an easy and short process. And I have great hope that this vineyard eventually will be classified Premier Cru, which will probably give justice to this amazing place.
Mm. Well, let's hope that happens. And it's fascinating to learn that in Alsace, you could never have what you have in Burgundy, which are these monopole Grand Cru like La Romanée or Romanée Conti itself. That wouldn't be allowed in Alsace. Now, let's go on to speak about what is maybe the most astonishing vineyard in the whole of Alsace, the greatest single site in Alsace. Again, one recognized since the Middle Ages. In the 17th century, I believe it was planted with 500 hectares. And this, of course, is the most southerly Grand Cru in the whole of Alsace, down in Tann, and it's the Rangen de Tann. Tell us something of this amazing story of the recovery of the Rangen de Tann, one of the great heroic stories of contemporary wine growing, I always think.
Yeah, you're right. The town of Tann had over 500 hectares of vineyard back in the 17th century. Unfortunately, French Revolution, disease, mildew, oidium, phylloxera, First World War, Second World War, and also the Industrial Revolution completely almost eradicated the culture of vineyard down in Tann. Tann is on a river called Thur, very close to a very important industrial city called Mulhouse. And most of the land available was taken up by industries. And the people, also the wine grower, saw a much better income going to work in factories and continuing to make wine. The Rangen is the only vineyard that survived because it's set on one of the steepest vineyards in Alsace, maybe in France. It's equivalent to some of the vineyards you can see in the Mosel. And because of the slope, and also the fact that the aristocracy of Tann always considered to be very important to own a little piece of vineyard in the Rangen. So when my father discovered this vineyard in the 60s and eventually managed to buy the first plot in 1977, he read a lot about the history of the vineyard, and there were still quite a lot of notables who owned tiny little pieces of vineyard just out of pride.
The Rangen vineyard is located on a rare and unique volcanic sedimentary rock. An ancient volcano that was active about 50 million years ago covered the area with ashes and fumes that eventually got compacted under the sea. The Rangen came out of the water and is looking full south on a very steep vineyard. The average slope is around 90%, with extreme going up to 130% of slope, which makes it extremely dramatic to look at. It's overlooking a river, the Thur River, and enjoys a very, very Mediterranean-style climate in summer. The high altitude of the vineyard makes it late to bud break, but eventually, due to the slope and the topography and the color of the soil, it catches up in summer, and it makes the Rangen able to produce extremely powerful and rich wines.
So it does make a wine that has also a unique taste in the region. Topography is completely amazing. Steep, south-facing, with this beautiful river right on the bottom, in a very dramatic valley with high mountains all around. It's a vineyard that I think and believe and see has a tremendous energy. You know, it has a force, it has a power, which is quite unique in the world of wine. And it makes it, it's not easy to understand. It has a powerful and strong character. It means that the taster needs to focus on the wine and concentrate to really get it. But once you reach that stage, it's a wine that is able to tell you a lot of things.
That's absolutely true. In fact, I often think, really, it's the ultimate terroir wine in that sense, because that the site seems to mark the wines to such an extraordinary extent. And certainly one of the great privileges of my wine traveling life was to go down to that vineyard a few years ago and have a taste of many of your wines and some of the other growers' wines. There are only, I think, four growers in the vineyard, including one is a cooperative grower.
Absolutely
astonishing. But I also walked around on that vineyard. It was, I think, the month of June. It was very warm and sunny. It was super hot. It was difficult. It was tough. It must be incredibly difficult to work in that vineyard, and for your father actually to clear it for viticulture in the first place. I mean, I don't know if you helped him at the time. I don't know how old you were, but that must have been a huge struggle, I think.
Yeah, no, I worked a lot in this vineyard when I was still a student, and during the school holidays, I would travel from Turkheim, from Windenheim, where we lived at the time, down to Tann. That was my summer jobs very often, to help the guys over there, because very, very hard work. And my father acquired about 3 hectares of planted vineyard. So we also had to plant 2.5 hectares between 78 and 2001, which was the last vineyard we planted in the Rangen. So you're right, the slope, the nature of the soil, which is covered by rocks, makes it extremely difficult to work there. Everything is done by hand, including plowings, and we use a winch. Spraying is amazingly difficult. So the five people who work there for 5.5 hectares, it's a high men vineyard ratio, are really, really brave and courageous people. And I never thank them enough, I can tell you that. It's really, really a hard job there. But sometimes it's not the hardest, most physical jobs, which are the most difficult mentally. And I have to say, you go home, you're tired and you sleep well, but it's a vineyard which is energizing you. You know, you have a magnificent view when you're in this vineyard. It's not a boring place to work. It's fascinating. So I tell you, by having worked in many of our vineyards and for a long time, I have more pleasure to work in the Rhineland than many other places.
Fascinating.
Before we end this interview, Andrew, Olivier, some of these very terroirs will be visited during the immersion trip in June, yes?
Yes, absolutely. Generally, we don't have a chance to get all the way down to Tann, unfortunately. It's my ambition one day in one of our study trips to Alsace to go all the way down there. But at the moment, we can't get down there. But we will certainly go and visit Olivier in Turckheim, and we'll have a good look around the Herrenweg all around us. And we will also travel to the village of Hunavir, where we go and have lunch on one day of our visits. And we'll make sure that in addition to seeing Ruzaker, which is the famous Grand Cru in Hunavir, that's the source of Trambach's Clos Saint-Une, we also look up to the Clos Vinspool and work out where that is too.
Well, that is certainly something to look forward to. And listeners, this concludes part one of our interview with Olivier Humbrecht. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast aggregator to catch the next part and future episodes. For more information on the region, upcoming immersion trips, or courses, go to wineschoolerguild.org.